First John chapter 3. We're on page 8 tomorrow, folks. And working our way through the latter part of chapter 3. You know, again, as we have seen in this epistle, one of the themes of John is love. The love of God, and then the love that we are to have. And in particular, the point of emphasis that comes back time and again, we'll see this tonight, is the love that we are to have for brethren. And sometimes John says some things that I think a little bit of a peculiar way, but it's to emphasize or make a point and to make it stronger. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer. Well, I mean, how do you equate hate with murder? Well, the Lord does. It's talking about an attitude is the point that he's getting at here. And the message, you know, to Christians was that it's not just our actions, what it's seen on the outside. But even it's what is in our heart that's important. Our heart says everything. I was going to say our heart says a lot about who we are, but you know, our heart says everything about who we are. And in time, at some point or another, what's in our heart is what's going to come out, is going to be made manifest, and others are going to see and know that too. And so these disciples, as they were feeling the pressure and hate of the world, you know, that gave them no excuse to have an evil heart just like the world had. There was no excuse that was being made for that. Jesus demonstrated only love, though the world hated him. And so we might take away from that the very idea and the very fact that hate cannot be a part of who we are. You know, there is a natural inclination for the man of the world to return hate for hate. And I think sometimes we have to fight against that ourselves. I mean, it's easy to give hate back on hate. But everything that I'm seeing here from what the apostle is saying is that that's just not who we are. If that was the case, I mean, if we're trying to be like Jesus, that cannot be who we are. Look over to Romans chapter 12 for just a moment. Romans chapter 12, verse 17. Interesting chapter 12 is one that just gives a variety of different instructions of godly living. Godly character, perhaps, is what would be said. In Romans 12, verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I mean, wonderful direction for life is what Paul is giving for us right there. So back in our text, you know, John is trying to help us respond as one born of God, that we would be, that we would have the character of God, that it would be seen in every aspect of our life, that we truly are a changed man. That's what Paul was saying in Romans 12. That we have changed in such a way that evil for evil doesn't, that's not what's in our mind. But we're going to give love where others give evil. That this is just who we are. Okay, so any thoughts that you have on some of those points?
Jesus thought that under the old law, if you shouldn't commit adultery, but under his law, even the lust would be the same as adultery. And I think that's the same thing Peter's saying right here.
Yeah, it's a heart issue.
Yeah, if you hate somebody, it's just as bad as if you had murdered that person.
Yeah.
Hate has no place.
Yeah, absolutely. Hate has no place.
That's right. It's like cursing without using a curse word.
there's still a problem in the heart. Okay? Good thoughts. All right. Let's, Jennifer.
Well, there's the thing you hear a lot, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't want that because, I mean, we've seen it just in the last year in our country. If you stand against something as blatant as homosexuality or something like that, you hate people like that. Hatred, because you don't agree. Today, it's like, if you don't agree with somebody, then that automatically makes you a bigot or a hater. I think sometimes when we try to talk to people about things, we need to be careful we don't come across that.
Yeah. And so what is coming out instead is love. Let's go back. Let's go to the text. Let's read a little bit here. We're in chapter 3, verse 16 is where we're taking up tonight. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God dwell in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. If our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God. And whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. And this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as he gave us commandment. Wow, let's spend a few minutes here. Love, demonstration versus indifference is what's being highlighted here. This is like Christ versus the heart of men. Our question, explain the difference in heart between Christ and the unresponsive Christian. How would you deal with that? How would you answer that? Explain the difference in heart between Christ and the unresponsive Christian. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Pretty well. Yeah, right. Really.
Well, Christ was willing to sacrifice his life for us. And I think, you know, we're commanded that we should be the same way, but we demonstrate that not necessarily through the sacrificing of our physical lives, but by making sure that if we see our brother or sister in need, and we've got the ability to take care of them, that we will sacrifice in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It may not even be a sacrifice if we have that ability, and you know, that
but willingness. Okay, good. What else? Anything else? I mean, Jesus demonstrated his love. I mean, here becomes the example for us. Jesus demonstrated his love. It was not talk only. It was action that took place. And without question, we can see his love. It was a self-sacrifice. You know, you think about Philippians chapter 2 and the description of Jesus, you know, in heaven, leaving all that heaven has to offer and giving up himself, humbling himself to come in the flesh, to walk in the flesh, to die on the cross. Everything about the description that is given highlights the fact of self-sacrifice. And Jesus did that because of love. And it seems to me that in the overall text, what John's trying to say is that we need to have a loving heart like Jesus had. You know, one that moves us to respond out of love. You know, love indeed, as verse 18 says, love indeed is that which is not in word only. Think about the parable of the Good Samaritan. You know, there are some characters in the story there that might be some who would talk big. You know, some religious type folks. That it might be assumed that they would respond in a positive and a loving way to someone in need, but did not. And in fact, it was the Samaritan, the one that was thought of as being low in life, not thought of as well, that demonstrated what a honest and pure and good heart is, and how one would respond to someone else in need, a stranger even, That's a need. To love one's neighbor as thyself is something that Jesus would have said. And so again, it, kind of the overview of some of the text here in this passage, you know, is the difference in heart between Christ and one who is unresponsive or unloving. That's what's being kind of laid out. I don't think it's the smoothest passage to read and understand. It's just kind of my view of that. You have to kind of work your way through it just a little bit. But that seems to be the overall point. There's another point that comes out from the text, though, to me, too, verses 19 through 21, more in particular. What is the role of our conscience? Look at verse 19 again. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. If our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God. Now, the question we had was, what is the role of our conscience? When we look at that text, what is the role of our conscience?
Is it to help us feel guilty when we're supposed to?
What's that?
We're supposed, when we are to convict us of sin and make us feel guilty when we're supposed to.
It will do that. A good conscience will do that.
It'll keep us straight if we've got the right mind.
He'll keep us straight if our conscience is what it should be. Okay? So that's what we say. This whole thing about conscience is interesting to me. Because there's a lot of different ideas that people have about conscience and what that is and how that works.
If we're taught right, our conscience, and we do something wrong, our conscience will condemn us.
Our conscience is going to bother us. Our conscience is going to tell us when there's something that's wrong. You know, we cannot honestly find easiness if our heart is not right. If our conscience is not what it should be. We cannot find easiness of heart. And if true love is not in us, which is the overall context of what's being said, if true love is not in us, then our conscience ought to be burdened. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God. This is the contrast. You know, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God, which is going to lead us into some other discussion about confidence here, but any other comments on that? Early.
I think it's also this idea of conscience and knowing the truth is related to this idea of love as well, because we know deep down in our heart, we know the truth about whether we're loving other people and treating other people the way we ought to. And our conscience is going to tell us what we ought to do and how not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point.
I forgot how I was going to say this, but our conscience can be wrong. We can have false confidence in our conscience. And in the context here, what we see is that if we are of the truth, then we can have confidence before God. That's where our conscience can be clean and we can be assured that our conscience is in line with what God would want it to be. But if we take the truth out of the picture, then our confidence is not educated. Mm-hmm. Our conscience is not educated and our confidence may be false. So.
Then our conscience cannot have a good bearing on which way to go. It used to be pretty common to hear people say, just let your conscience be your guide when you're trying to make a decision. Let your conscience be your guide. Well, that's not necessarily good advice. You know, because if your heart and your mind is set on evil things and you know, your conscience has become seared to such things, why not bother your conscience at all to do what is evil? You know, it doesn't bother your conscience, so it's okay. Well, no, your conscience cannot always be a good guide. Like Rick was saying, if our conscience is set on the right standard, well, our conscience is meant to help us. It's meant to bother us when we're doing things that we shouldn't.
Well, you know, Paul persecuted Christians with a clear conscience.
That's right.
And he said so.
Yeah. That's a good point.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Right. You know, Paul talks about, and then he has some experience with conscience, he says something about our conscience being seared with a hot iron. And that kind of gives us a picture of our conscience being damaged in such a way that it just no longer can be responsive the way it needs to be. But in our text, the upside to all of this in our text, you know, John is saying something about the fact that we can have a good conscience. One that actually helps us to be comfortable in a good way. When we know that we are living as God would want us to live, when we know that we have taken His Word into His heart, when we know that we are making choices based on what this Word says, then we can have a good conscience and confidence. That's the next point. Because now he talks about that, you know, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God.
All right.
So explain that, or our question is, what points can be made about confidence toward God? What would you say? Confidence.
I think the whole text from chapter 1 on, if you'll look at how many times he uses the word know, K-N-O-W, we know this because of this. We know this. Every time it has to do with obedience. When you obey, it causes you to know. Therefore, you have confidence. It's not a doubt. So what John is saying is, if you look at this, if you look at truth, if you look at your reaction to truth, if you obey it, then you'll have confidence that Jesus is going to do what he says he's going to do. And we can see it in our relationship with one another. He says that. So he goes through several things. Verse 14, we know that we pass from death, from death into life. Mm-hmm. Earlier it says, looking back here, verse 19 says, hereby we know that we are of truth. Mm-hmm. And then chapter 6, or verse 6, or verse 2, next chapter. Hereby knowing the Spirit of God. In verse 6, bear it not us, hereby knowing we are the Spirit of truth. And we know the Spirit of truth, we know the Spirit of truth. We can see that in how people react to truth. He makes those points. But he brings, you know, to the personal level, is that we need to have assurance, really. I think if we sing the song, blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. Well, how do we have that? I think you mentioned this last class. Sometimes what we do is somebody will say, do you think you're going to go to heaven? And you might make a statement, well, I sure hope so. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the wrong answer. Mm-hmm. We should know
right.
If we're in line. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he's trying to get these people to know here. Mm-hmm. Is you should know that. We know that. He's encouraging them. Blessed assurance.
You know, we're reminded again of one of the themes here of this epistle, that there are things that we can know. We can know we stand right before God. You know, we can know the truth that He has delivered. We can know His will. And when these things are in place, there is a confidence that we can have that the world cannot have and does not know. And you remember earlier on some things we talked about in view of some of the philosophies of the day, the Gnostics and those who, some who would say, well, there's nothing else for certain. You can't really know anything. And there is, of course, saying there is no God and there is not this, there is not that. The Gnostics were the ones who were saying, you can't know these things. John is saying over and over and over again, yes, you can. You can know. You can have confidence in these things. And here's how you can know. Do we see that coming out of the text now more? I mean, coming all the way through, we're seeing this. And so it's having the knowledge of these things that gives us confidence toward God. That's a beautiful thing.
Joe, Alex has his hand up.
Wave big.
Thinking of a really good example. When he comes to Jesus,
the heart. Absolutely.
Love each other, being able to sacrifice for your fellow man.
Jesus taught it. Jesus demonstrated it. John is using Jesus as the example over and over. Certainly we see that in the Gospel of John. And now he's still using Jesus as the example, you know, of what motivated Jesus was doing what was right. And here's what he's trying to say to us, is that we can know the truth. We can know we stand right. We can choose between hatred and love. And all of these elements are seated in the heart. We'll see as we get into chapter 4 some more points that I think go along, you know, with this very idea. Is that which comes from the heart is going to determine the direction we go. We better make sure the heart is right. I mean, even if we wind up doing the right things, but it's with the wrong motivation, because there's a heart problem, we're still in trouble. Good thoughts. Let's see here. What other questions we have with this? On page 8, toward the bottom, once again, fellowship with the Lord is the topic of John's writing. How can we have confidence of that fellowship? We've kind of talked about that some. I want to think about it in that term, because going back to the first chapter, you know, he was talking about how can we have fellowship with God? How do we know? How can we have confidence now of this fellowship with God? Verse 24 gives us the answer. Keeping his commandments. That's that reoccurring theme that John keeps bringing up. Our confidence comes by keeping his commandments. Then he dwells in us. And we can know that, as the text says, that he abides in us when we live by his word. We can know when we abide in his word, we can know he abides in us.
I think it's interesting in verse 23, it says, and this is his commandment, that we believe in the name of his son Jesus Christ. Why doesn't it just say that we believe in Jesus Christ? And we see that also in the Gospel of John, in the name of. Yeah. And I believe when we read that, what we see is in the authority of Jesus Christ. And if we believe in the authority, then we're going to do what he tells us to do and listen to his word and do it. Yeah. It's not just an acknowledgement of who he is, it's an acknowledgement of his authority as well.
Well, that's a good point. I didn't think about that at all. I think that's right, that the whole point, the principle there is identifying the authority of Jesus. I mean, we would make that same point and same argument from Colossians 3, verse 17. When Paul says, whatever you do in word or in deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God, the Father, through him. We would identify again, you know, that whatever we do has to be by the authority of the Lord. Yeah, good add, good point. All right, let's look on here into the next chapter, chapter 4. And that's lesson number 5, if you pick that up. And I want to kind of read the introduction here, just kind of get us started into this next chapter, get some points in our mind. The chapter begins with John teaching the disciples that not only can they have confidence in their own faith and convictions, but they have the ability to sort out those who would wish to destroy that faith. The test that he provided for them to use is really not so hard. And in this chapter, once again, a familiar theme is struck: love, God's love, and what our love toward him and our brethren should look like. It is interesting that love is mentioned over 50 times in John's epistles. It should not be too hard for us to understand that God is making an incredible point of emphasis right here, and he sees our struggles with the kind of love we need to have. Chapter 3 closed with the understanding that those who keep God's commandments have fellowship with him. In this chapter, John provides a little more detail on that, that we have to believe that Jesus is the Son of God who came in the flesh, and be aware of those who teach otherwise. That summarizes a little bit where we're going here in this next chapter. Chapter 4, verse 1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God. Because many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming, and even now it is already in the world. You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he is in you, or he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. They are of the world. Therefore they speak as the world, as of the world, and the world hears them. We are of God. He who knows God hears us. He who is not of God does not hear us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Those are some really good points here. In these verses, I think, kind of stand out here. Do not believe every spirit, John says, but test them. So explain first, our question, explain first what John is questioning the disciples about in verse 1. Number one, don't believe everything you hear. You know, how many times you say that to your kids? You know, when you're coming up, or how many times was it said to you? You can't believe everything you hear. You have to find some basis of truth. And John's saying that to the disciples here. You know, you have to look for the basis of truth. Here's a test. Don't believe everything that you hear. Don't be fooled by everyone who claims to be religious. And I'll tell you, as we have seen, and as we have discussed in some detail already, you know that the issues that John was dealing with these disciples long ago and the Gnostic beliefs and things of that nature are just really not all that different today. You know, we're dealing with some of the same principles and problems, you know, today. Don't be fooled by everyone who claims to be religious. There's a lot of people who claim to be religious. That's not hard to do. But that doesn't make one right. You know, there's a test here that's given. You know, remember, John has just finished talking about and teaching those who keep God's commandments have fellowship with him. It's something we have to keep in mind today. Everybody, anybody religious, you know, Christian religion, claims fellowship with God. Well, what determines that fellowship? Well, what John has just said, those who keep God's commandments. In fact, he has said that how many times already? You know, that's the big point of emphasis. In chapter 4, John makes a point of emphasis about what was already said, you know, that we should believe on the name of the Lord, we should obey the will of God, verses 1 through 6, that stands out. And then in verses 7 through 21, going on, there's the emphasis of love one another. I mean, in the chapter, there's these two main themes that will stand out. You know, to obey the will of God and to love one another. And so he begins this by saying, test the spirits. You know, something that is relevant instruction for today. But now here's the question for us would all be, why test? Why do we have to test the spirits? What's your immediate response that comes to that? Why do we have to test the spirits?
Because many false prophets have gone out into the world, he says.
That's it. Many false prophets have gone out into the world. I mean, that's the warning that he's given here. And it's not any less today. You know, not in any way is it less. And you know, as we said, the prominent teaching today says it really doesn't matter what you believe. As long as you believe in God, you know, that's all that matters. And yet that very prominent philosophy, that very prominent teaching today has no scriptural basis to it at all. What are some of your thoughts?
I think we need to even look at this in a broader context. Don't keep our minds centered on organized religions, but the world as a whole is filled with false prophets that would lead us astray. And so a lot of what we're hearing as false doctrine is coming from outside of organized religion.
Very true. Very true. Good point.
So I just think it's interesting, like Buddha says, like that the Antichrist, specifically the spirits of the Antichrist, reject Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. And I think that's different, like in the world today, you see between denominations that still, you know, believe, like have a semblance, they believe in Jesus Christ in the flesh, and versus denominations that are then turned into cults, particularly like Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints and Jehovah's Witness.
Mm-hmm.
They then replace Jesus Christ with typically, you know, a leader of that.
Yeah, so their prophets or whatever.
Which is like another step
mm-hmm.
in a direction further than just a denomination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and like with the Gnostics, there were those Gnostics of the day who were denying Christ. You know, they're absolutely denying Christ came in the flesh. Here was one of the tests. You know, to you know, in testing the spirits. Here was one of the tests. Was do they confess Jesus has come in the flesh? And of course, the Gnostics, no, they would argue against that. You know, and so this is Antichrist. And we already saw back in chapter 2, we had quite a bit of discussion on Antichrist when it first comes up there, you know. And so there's a point to be made right there.
I think we need to be a little bit careful here because I think this is a somewhat limited context. Because someone can take this passage and say, well, as long as you say that Jesus Christ came in the flesh, exactly. then you're of God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about those people in Matthew 7:21?
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone who says unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father is in heaven. Those people apparently believe that Jesus Christ came in the flesh because they're doing all these works in his
That's
name
right.
and doing what he said. So we've got to be careful not to just take that one little passage out of context and say, well, if you believe that Jesus came in the flesh, you're
okay.
You're of God.
You're of God. Interesting. Because now, I think there's two things we've seen already. You know, this, I mean, here is this test a very stark example of those who are don't even believe Jesus came in the flesh. That's being called out. But how many times already has he said, you know, you're a child of God if you do his commandments? And he's going to still say that as we go forward. And so it's not just a matter, I mean, this is a valid point, it's a good point that has to be brought out here, that you have those who absolutely deny Christ. That really stands out. But what John is also making throughout the epistle is the point that there are many. There could be many who say they are of Christ, who believe Jesus came in the flesh, but they don't do his commandments. And already he has said, you can't be a child of God if you don't do his commandments.
I think the context is specifically talking about the Gnostic teaching
mm-hmm.
that's going on there.
I think this point here,
I think,
you just said.
I think this verse 2 and 3 here, that's really what it's dealing with. Of course, we can still make the application
mm-hmm.
to our circumstances today. And to Rick's point, you know, people in the KKK confess that Jesus came in the flesh.
Right.
And they're out murdering people.
Right.
So, you know, that's not the one litmus test that proves
mm-hmm.
you're good for God.
Absolutely. Good point.
And in addition to that is verse 6. Another test is if you're not listening to the apostles, because it says we are from God, he who knows God listens to us. He who is not from God does not listen to us. By this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Would that be the apostles?
I think so.
Yeah.
And we'll look at that a little before we get to that. I think that's a good point. You know, and so there is a reason, there's got to be a reason why John became so specific here, you know, about this Antichrist and those who denied Christ coming in the flesh. There has to be a reason for that because obviously there were those, history would tell us, that were making that claim. And yet in the bigger part of John's epistle, that's not his point. I mean, the bigger part of John's epistle is the emphasis over and over again, even though you're a child of God, if you obey his commandments. And that takes in a much bigger view or picture. Think for a moment here, back in 2 Timothy chapter 4, something that Paul said. That, I think, makes a parallel point in 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning at verse 2, what he said to Timothy. You know the passage. Preach the word, be ready in season, out of season, convince, rebuke, exhort, with all longsuffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers. They will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. He's not saying these people aren't religious. And in fact, he's not even saying that they don't believe that Christ came in the flesh. He's just saying that they have taken on doctrines that are more appealing to them. But it can't be right. But you be watchful in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of evangelists, fulfill your work in the ministry. You know, prominent teaching today says doctrine does not matter. God says it does. I mean, everywhere we go, God says doctrine matters.
Earlier he was talking about those who went out from us, and we knew they weren't of us because they weren't heeding the word. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this sort of fits with that. He's not talking about everyone in the world in general, I think, in this particular context. He's talking about that particular church, the group, the issues that they were facing, and those among those brethren who would say that Christ did not come in the flesh, mm-hmm. is not of us. Mm-hmm. You know, and many false prophets have already gone out. I'm not sure that's exactly the case, but it seems to fit the context of what he said earlier as well.
Good points. That's on the print.
I'm just going to say that the verse 22 that y'all discussed before I came in here, when he makes the statement, he is an antichrist. He puts together he denies the Father and the Son.
Mm-hmm.
When you deny one, you're denying both of them. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Yeah.
When we go to 2 John, verse 7, mm-hmm. he mentions that again, but he says that those people that are liars, that are deceivers, they are a antichrist. Not that that's all that can be an antichrist. Like Rick said, it's not just mm-hmm. that, well, as long as I believe that, means I'm not.
Right.
It's just one thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It becomes a pretty broad description, antichrist. And we saw that a little bit more in chapter 2. We spent more time there, and it was a little bit of a broader context there. You know, again, as has been said, John's trying to make a specific point here. I think, really, because of the Gnostic teachers. But you got to take that in view of the whole about what all else is said here, you know, as well, you know, and see that too. You know, being religious does not mean that, does not mean righteousness. You know, I mean, always, we go back in the Old Testament, always there have been those who have been perceived as religious who had or were teaching doctrines that were not from God or believing in gods, you know, false gods. That's always been an issue. So being religious does not make one right. I mean, Satan's greatest tactic when, you know, that wolf in sheep's clothing is when he is able to portray something religious and portray it as being right when it has no spiritual basis at all. That's one of the most powerful things that he has been able to do and accomplish. But, and I think Rick said this, made this point, that is just so powerful and so strong from Matthew chapter 7. You know, beginning at verse 21, Jesus says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father which is in heaven. And certainly here we're not talking about those who have denied that Jesus came in the flesh, because if that were the case, why would they be doing, doing religious things? Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonderful works in your name? You know, if there was ever a very simple answer to the question, is there such a thing as lost religious people? Well, Jesus said yes. Right here. And I will declare to them, I never knew you, you who practice lawlessness. Depart from me, he says.
I'll take you one step further. Not only is there, will there be lost religious people, there will be lost people who believe in Jesus Christ.
Absolutely.
That
That's what that passage teaches. Absolutely. Good points. I appreciate you coming along there and making some good points and keeping us moving. Lord willing, on Sunday, we'll take up there about the middle of page 9 and work our way through chapter 4. So make sure you have lesson 5 and work on that. We'll be good to go.